Chapter 4. As the first tinge of dawn reddened the sea, a small boat with a solitary occupant approached the cliffs. The man in the boat was a picturesque figure. A crimson scarf was knotted about his head. His wide silk breeches, of flaming hue, were upheld by a broad sash which likewise supported a scimitar and shagreen scabbard. His gilt-worked leather boots suggested the horseman rather than the seaman, but he handled his boat with skill. Through his widely open white silk shirt showed his broad muscular breast, burned brown by the sun. The muscles of his heavy bronzed arms rippled as he pulled the oars with an almost feline ease of motion. A fierce vitality that was evident in each feature and motion set him apart from the common man, yet his expression was neither savage nor somber, though the smoldering blue eyes hinted at ferocity easily awakened. This was Conan, who had wandered into the armed camps of the Cossacks with no other possession than his wits and his sword, and who had carved his way to leadership among them. He paddled to the carven stair as one familiar with his environs and moored the boat to a projection of the rock. Then he went up the worn steps without hesitation. He was keenly alert, not because he consciously suspected hidden danger, but because alertness was a part of him, whetted by the wild existence he followed. What Kasnavi had considered animal intuition or some sixth sense was merely the razor-edged faculties and savage wit of the barbarian. Conan had no instinct to tell him that men were watching him from a covert among the reeds of the mainland. As he climbed the cliff, one of these men breathed deeply and stealthily lifted a bow. Jahangir caught his wrist and hissed an oath into his ear.
"Fool, will you betray us? Don't you realize he is out of range? Let him get upon the island. He will go looking for the girl. We will stay here a while. He may have guessed our presence or guessed our plot. He may have warriors hidden somewhere. We will wait. In an hour, if nothing suspicious happens, we'll row up to the foot of the stair and wait him there. If he does not return in a reasonable time, some of us will go upon the island and hunt him down. But I do not wish to do that if it can be helped. Some of us are sure to die if we go into the bush after him. I had rather catch him with arrows from a safe distance."
Meanwhile, the unsuspecting Cossack had plunged into a forest. He went silently in his soft leather boots, his gaze sifting every shadow in eagerness to catch sight of the splendid, tawny-haired beauty of whom he had dreamed ever since he had seen her in the pavilion of Jahangir Aga by Fort Kori. He would have desired her even if she had displayed repugnance toward him, but her cryptic smiles and glances had fired his blood, and with all the lawless violence which was his heritage, he desired that white-skinned, golden-haired woman of civilization. He had been on Jaipur before. Less than a month ago, he had held a secret conclave here with a pirate crew. He knew that he was approaching a point where he could see the mysterious ruins which gave the island its name, and he wondered if he could find the girl hiding among them. Even with the thought, he stopped as though struck dead. Ahead of him, among the trees, rose something that his reason told him was not possible. It was a great dark green wall, with towers rearing beyond the battlements. Conan stood paralyzed in the disruption of the faculties which demoralizes anyone who is confronted by an impossible negation of sanity. He doubted neither his sight nor his reason, but something was monstrously out of joint. Less than a month ago, only broken ruins had showed among the trees. What human hands could rear such a mammoth pile as now met his eyes in the few weeks which had elapsed? Besides, the buccaneers who roamed Villiette ceaselessly would have learned of any work going on such a stupendous scale and would have informed the Cossacks. There was no explaining this thing, but it was so. He was on Jaipur, and that fantastic heap of towering masonry was on Jaipur, and all was madness and paradox, yet it was all true. He wheeled to race back through the jungle, down the carven stair, and across the blue waters to the distant camp at the mouth of the Zaporaska. In that moment of unreasoning panic, even the thought of halting so near the inland sea was repugnant. He would leave it behind him, would quit the armed camps and the steppes, and put 1,000 miles between him and the blue mysterious east, where the most basic laws of nature could be set at naught by what diabolism he could not guess. For an instant, the future fate of kingdoms that hinged on this gay-clad barbarian hung in the balance. It was a small thing that tipped the scales, merely a shred of silk hanging on a bush that caught his uneasy glance. He leaned to it, his nostrils expanding, his nerves quivering to a subtle stimulant. on that bit of torn cloth, so faint that it was less with his physical faculties than by some obscure instinctive sense that he recognized it, lingered the tantalizing perfume that he connected with the sweet, firm flesh of the woman he had seen in Jahangir's pavilion. The fisherman had not lied then. She was here. Then, in the soil, he saw a single track in the loam. The track of a bare foot, long and slender, but a man's, not a woman's, and sunk deeper than was natural. The conclusion was obvious. The man who had made that track was carrying a burden. And what should it be but the girl the Cossack was seeking? He stood silently facing the dark towers that loomed through the trees, his eyes slits of blue balefire. Desire for the yellow-haired woman vied with a sullen, primordial rage at whoever had taken her. His human passion fought down his ultra-human fears, and dropping into the stalking crouch of a hunting panther, he glided toward the walls, taking advantage of the dense foliage to escape detection from the battlements. As he approached, he saw that the walls were composed of the same green stone that had formed the ruins, and he was haunted by a vague sense of familiarity. It was as if he looked upon something that he had never seen before, but had dreamed or pictured mentally. At last he recognized the sensation. The walls and towers followed the plan of the ruins. It was as if the crumbling lines had grown back into the structures they originally were. No sound disturbed the morning quiet as Conan stole to the foot of the wall, which rose sheer from the luxuriant growth. On the southern reaches of the inland sea, the vegetation was almost tropical. He saw no one on the battlements, heard no sound within. He saw a massive gate a short distance to his left and had no reason to suppose that it was not locked and guarded, but he believed that the woman he sought was somewhere beyond that wall, and the course he took was characteristically reckless. Above him, vine-festooned branches reached out toward the battlements. He went up a great tree like a cat, and reaching a point above the parapet, gripped a thick limb with both hands, swung back and forth at arm's length until he had gained momentum and then let go and catapulted through the air, landing cat-like on the battlements. Crouching there, he stared down at the streets of the city. The circumference of the wall was not great, but the number of green stone buildings it contained was surprising. They were 3 or 4 stories in height, mainly flat-roofed, reflecting a fine architectural style. The streets converged like the spokes of a wheel into an octagon-shaped court in the center of the town, which gave upon a lofty edifice, which, with its domes and towers, dominated the whole city. He saw no one moving in the streets or looking out of the windows, though the sun was already coming up. The silence that reigned there might have been that of a dead and deserted city. A narrow stone stair ascended the wall near him. Down this he went. Houses shouldered so closely to the wall that halfway down the stair he found himself within arm's length of a window and halted to peer in. There were no bars, and the silk curtains were caught back with satin cords. He looked into a chamber whose walls were hidden by dark velvet tapestries. The floor was covered with thick rugs, and there were benches of polished ebony and an ivory dais heaped with furs. He was about to continue his descent when he heard the sound of someone approaching in the street below. Before the unknown person could round a corner and see him on the stair, he stepped quickly across the intervening space and dropped lightly into the room, drawing his scimitar. He stood for a moment, statue-like. Then, as nothing happened, he was moving across the rugs toward an arched doorway when a hanging was drawn aside, revealing a cushioned alcove from which a slender, dark-haired girl regarded him with languid eyes. Conan glared at her tensely, expecting her momentarily to start screaming. But she merely smothered a yawn with a dainty hand, rose from the alcove, and leaned negligently against the hanging which she held with one hand. She was undoubtedly a member of a white race, although her skin was very dark. Her square-cut hair was black as midnight, her only garment a wisp of silk about her supple hips. Presently she spoke, but the tongue was unfamiliar to him, and he shook his head. She yawned again, stretched lithely, and without any show of fear or surprise, shifted to a language he did understand, a dialect of Yetchi, which sounded strangely archaic.
"Are you looking for someone?"
she asked, as indifferently as if the invasion of her chamber by an armed stranger were the most common thing imaginable.
"Who are you?" he demanded.
"I am Yeteli,"
she answered languidly.
"I must have feasted late last night. I am so sleepy now. Who are you?"
"I am Conan, a hetman among the Cossacks," he answered, watching her narrowly.
He believed her attitude to be a pose and expected her to try to escape from the chamber or rouse the house. But though a velvet rope that might be a signal cord hung near her, she did not reach for it.
"Conan," she repeated drowsily, "you are not a Dagonian. I suppose you are a mercenary. Have you cut the heads off many yet, she?"
"I do not war on water rats," he snorted.
"But they are very terrible," she murmured. "I remember when they were our slaves, but they revolted and burned and slew. Only the magic of Kostrelkel has kept them from the walls."
She paused, a puzzled look struggling with the sleepiness of her expression.
"I forgot," she muttered. "They did climb the walls. Last night there was shouting and fire and the people calling in vain on Kostrel."
She shook her head as if to clear it.
"But that cannot be," she murmured, "because I am alive, and I thought I was dead. Oh, the devil with it!"
She came across the chamber, and taking Conan's hand, drew him to the dais. He yielded in bewilderment and uncertainty. The girl smiled at him like a sleepy child. Her long, silky lashes drooped over dusky, clouded eyes. She ran her fingers through his thick black locks as if to assure herself of his reality.
"Perhaps it was a dream,"
she yawned.
"Perhaps it's all a dream. I feel like a dream now. I don't care. I can't remember something. I have forgotten. There is something I cannot understand, but I grow so sleepy when I try to think. Anyway, it doesn't matter."
"What do you mean?" he asked uneasily. "You said they climbed the walls last night. Who?"
"The Yetchi. I thought so anyway. A cloud of smoke hid everything, but a naked, blood-stained devil caught me by the throat and drove his knife into my breast. Oh, it hurt, but it was a dream, because, see, there is no scar."
She idly inspected her smooth bosom, then sank upon Conan's lap and passed her supple arms about his massive neck.
"I cannot remember,"
she murmured, nestling her dark head against his mighty breast.
"Everything is dim and misty. It does not matter. You are no dream. You are strong. Let us live while we can. Love me."
He cradled the girl's glossy head in the bend of his heavy arm and kissed her full red lips with unfeigned relish.
"You are strong,"
she repeated, her voice waning.
"Love me. Love."
The sleepy murmur faded away. The dusky eyes closed, the long lashes drooping over the sensuous cheeks, the supple body relaxed in Conan's arms. He scowled down at her. She seemed to partake of the illusion that haunted this whole city, but the firm resilience of her limbs under his questing fingers convinced him that he had a living human girl in his arms, and not the shadow of a dream. No less disturbed, he hastily laid her on the furs upon the dais. Her sleep was too deep to be natural. He decided that she must be an addict of some drug, perhaps like the Black Lotus of Xuthal. Then he found something else to make him wonder. Among the furs on the dais was a gorgeous spotted skin whose predominant hue was golden. It was not a clever copy, but the skin of an actual beast. And that beast, Conan knew, had been extinct for at least 1,000 years. It was the great golden leopard which figures so prominently in Hyborian legendry, and which the ancient artists delighted to portray in pigments and marble. Shaking his head in bewilderment, Conan passed through the archway into a winding corridor. Silence hung over the house, but outside he heard a sound which his keen ears recognized as something ascending the stair on the wall from which he had entered the building. An instant later he was startled to hear something land with a soft but weighty thud on the floor of the chamber he had just quitted. Turning quickly away, he hurried along the twisting corridor until something on the floor before him brought him to a halt. It was a human figure, which lay half in the hall and half in an opening that obviously was normally concealed by a door, which was a duplicate of the panels of the wall. It was a man, dark and lean, clad only in a silk loincloth, with a shaven head and cruel features, and he lay as if death had struck him just as he was emerging from the panel. Conan bent above him, seeking the cause of his death, and discovered him to be merely sunk in the same deep sleep as the girl in the chamber. But why should he select such a place for his slumbers? While meditating on the matter, Conan was galvanized by a sound behind him. Something was moving up the corridor in his direction. A quick glance down it showed that it ended in a great door, which might be locked. Conan jerked the supine body out of the panel entrance and stepped through, pulling the panel shut after him. A click told him it was locked in place. Standing in utter darkness, he heard a shuffling tread halt just outside the door, and a faint chill trickled along his spine. That was no human step, nor that of any beast he had ever encountered. There was an instant of silence, then a faint creak of wooden metal. Putting out his hand, he felt the door straining and bending inward, as if a great weight were being steadily borne against it from the outside. As he reached for his sword, this ceased, and he heard a strange slobbering mouthing that prickled the short hairs on his scalp. Scimitar in hand, he began backing away, and his heels felt steps down which he nearly tumbled. He was in a narrow staircase leading downward. He groped his way down in the blackness, feeling for but not finding some other opening in the walls. Just as he decided that he was no longer in the house but deep in the earth under it, the steps ceased in a level tunnel.